This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 79 of What's It Like. My guest is Andy Anako, somewhere in Massachusetts?
Yep. I've been in New England, well, all day long, but most of my life besides that.
You grew up in that area?
Yeah, exactly. I grew up just outside of Boston.
Did you come from a large family?
Large enough, about 4 or 5 kids.
Oh, where are you in the pecking order?
I'm the youngest.
The baby of the family. When you were growing up, who had the biggest influence on your life?
Let's see, if we exclude family members, because that's kind of unfair, probably Douglas Adams, the science fiction author, because that's the one guy, that the one person that I can explicitly remember reading his stuff and thinking, gosh, I think I understand something I didn't understand before. I would love to go and try to do the sort of things that he's doing. I wrote my first like recreational piece of fiction, like not court ordered by the school system, after reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I've been writing ever since.
What was your major challenge as a child?
Ooh, that's a broad question. Probably my nerdiness. it's such a big crutch sometimes to say, oh, well, I was not understood as a child. I was interested in reading books that wasn't popular with the jocks out there. No, I don't mean that. But there's certain bits of software that you're responsible for building for your own makeup. And some people get the social software up and running in a very, very functional and practical way many years before some of the others. And I was one of those kids who, you know, the humans baffled and frustrated him on a regular basis. And certainly part of that had to do with the fact that, yes, I was the kid who was like into Star Wars and reading books. But also part of it was that I just didn't know that, well, if someone makes fun of you on the school ground, they're not mean and they're not being jerks. They're just, you know, making fun of people in the schoolyard. Your job is to, you know, make fun back and, you know, sort of participate, as opposed to say, yeah, you people are stupid. I'm not going to hang out with you people anymore. You're stupid.
What was school like for you?
Pretty good. I think I had a pretty average school experience. If you think that there, you can get from kindergarten through grade 12, at least, without considerable ups and downs. Boy, if you figure that out, please write a pamphlet and distribute it to the kids a couple years earlier than you, because there's always going to be those tests and trials. It's only in retrospect that you realize that it's actually quite valuable that in sixth grade, you've grown up with these people for six grades in a row, and now you get thrown into this central school where you have to sort of start all over again. And then 2 years after that, you get thrown into high school and you have to start pretty much all over again. Not that you get rid of all of the friends you had, but you have to start to learn how to cope with and meet and get interested by a whole new group of people. And that's really, really very valuable. And, of course, there were times when, once again, oh, gee, you people are stupid. I don't know why I hang out with these people. They're stupid. I was going to stay in my room and write, because, you know, it makes sense when I stay home and write. And I want to go with these stupid people. But yeah, I'd say that my school was a pretty good year. It's you miss those times when you're just free to sort of spend your entire day learning about stuff. And when you're young, people who are 10 years older than you are actually 10 and 20 years older than you. They're actually quite interested if you say, I'd like to learn how to program this machine. I understand you know how to program this machine. What do I need to do in order to learn this sort of stuff? And when you're 30, they probably will not let you have access to like a closed off part of the building and give you time on this very, very expensive computer. Whereas when you're 10 or 11 or 12, they are, oh my God, this is wonderful. I could be a mentor. I can teach someone. Oh, this is wonderful. Yes, absolutely. Here, have $10,000 worth of computer time on a $50,000 computer. Please, please.
When you graduated from high school, what did you do then?
That's when it all started to fall apart. I'm sorry.
Well, at least you had through high school.
At least I had those 4 months during school, 2 days at a time, when I felt at peace and happy.
That's right.
Well, after that, I went to school to a tech college, where three or 4,000 like people who were all like the nerds of their school. So that was a fun experience.
Hmm. you didn't go to writing?
I always sort of thought that writing would be this thing that I do on the side, that I would be a developer, a programmer, writing operating systems, that sort of thing. And writing was always the thing I did recreationally. Also, I think that just historically, I always had that sort of mind of thinking that, well, writing is not something you really teach. Writing is something that you just figure out on your own. There was that moment, I think, in probably my junior year in high school, when I kind of figured out that I would have to stop writing according to the rules that are being taught to me. That if I wanted to make it to the next level of being satisfied with my work, I would have to start breaking all the rules that were working perfectly fine for years and years. I was really one of those in English class. It was pretty much a given that I'd be getting an A or an A minus in every paper I handed in. There was a tradition in our school besides where the major exams, the midterms, and the final, every class you'd have the choice between either taking a long multiple choice test for like 2.5 hours, or you could take an essay test at the same time, which they give you 5 topics, you pick 3 and answer 3. And man, that was just cakewalk for me. Like every single one of these exams were, because the teachers aren't terribly used to people who can write really, really well. And also you get it down to, I don't need to be fancy here, 5 paragraphs, paragraph 1, answer the question, paragraphs 2, 3, and 4, come up with a different example to support your answer to the question. Question 5, restate and re-answer the question, you're done. I remember my Western Civ teacher once saying, I had, as usual, handed in my exam like about an hour before everybody else and say, okay, next time I'm installing a drive-through window for you and not go, because I was out of there like as fast as possible. But I do remember this time when I just had I was faced with yet another essay on Kafka's Metamorphosis, and thinking that, okay, I know how to get an A on this paper. I know what I'm supposed to be saying about this. I also know the form in which I'm supposed to be writing about this. I really have to start making mistakes, like writing some really bad stuff again by experimenting. And hand in the paper, got something like a C or C minus, because to be honest, it wasn't a very good paper. I was trying to figure out new forms and new ways of trying to answer that question. And got the C+, was offered a chance to rewrite it again to improve my grade, and decided that, nope, I'll take the C+, and I'll figure out a way to write in a new and different way that's experimental for me, and still get at least the B+ or maybe even the A-. So that's the sort of track I was on. I felt as though it was more valuable to learn how to write by continuing to write every day and continuing to be critical about my own stuff. Things about Turing machines, that's the sort of stuff I couldn't figure out on my own. So that's why, I went to that's why my major was computer science.
So what exactly do you do?
That's a question my mom would ask almost every single day in my adult life. Really, I'm a freelance journalist, which means that there are a bunch of different websites, magazines, and newspapers that take regular columns for me. So the marquee job that I do is I'm the Chicago Sun-Times tech columnist. And every time over the course of the week, I come up with a thought that make a good idea for a column, either a new piece of technology that people might have heard of that they might want might be thinking about buying, or something that I've heard of that sounds really, really cool, or a news story that I'd like to comment on, or just anything that I think that someone who's not as obsessed about technology as I am would find value in learning about. I sit down and write out anywhere from 800 words to sometimes 4,000 or 5,000 words on it, and it gets read a second, much cut down version for the print edition of the paper. And I do that anywhere from 1 to 3 or 4 times a week. And that's the sort of thing that I do for all the different publications that I work for. And on top of everything else, I do books occasionally. I go out and speak. There occasionally I'll do a consulting gig, but it's not a big part of my week or my month.
Do you have any desire to write the great American novel?
I think that's sort of a selfish goal. honestly, I mean, you're saying that there's this masterpiece that, God, thank God for me for writing this, that now society has the great Gatsby, piece of junk. I can't believe they're making people read that. The only reason why kids are being forced to read that in school is because they don't have my brilliant novel yet. Fiction is an area that I haven't, I've always written it. I've never really published it. That's one of my goals over the next year or two, is to start doing self-publishing for that sort of stuff. It's just, and really it's with the exact same attitude with which I write about anything else. And I think if you sit down with the idea that you're going to change the world with this piece of genius, you know, that everything that you write is going to be a perfect gem of truth, beauty, and wisdom, that's really the most dreary thing ever. My goal, particularly with the fiction, is just to write something that when someone gets to the end of it, they'll think, that this person didn't waste their time in reading it, that they'll get entertained, they'll be amused by it, and hopefully they'll say, gee, next time that this guy writes something and publishes it, I want to take a look at it. Mm-hmm. So those are pretty low goals, but still, there's always that first time that you decide that, okay, I am actually going to release this, I am actually going to let other people read it. It's kind of interesting the way that the internet has changed the process of publishing. It used to be that by the time someone that you don't know has had a chance to read what you've written, there are at least a minimum of half a dozen and probably 20 or 30 people who have agreed with your assertion that what you've written is worth reading. Now you can just toss it up there on a blog and boy, the results can be pretty variable. I think there's some brilliant stuff that's being published that way. And I actually think that it's the right direction for publishing, that anybody who wants to put themselves out there and go through the trouble and sometimes the expense of self-publishing, that's the only barrier that there should be. If you feel that passionately about what you do, you should be able to do that. That said, One of the things that sort of kept me off of publishing my fiction before is seeing all of these blogs maintained by writers, and you can sort of tell that the reason why they're publishing or the reason why they have this blog is because they like to think of themselves as writers. Mm-hmm. And I've seen these blogs before where there'll be one out of every three is about the process that they go through when they write. And there'll be another blog post about how they, you know, no store-bought pen and ink is sufficient for the experience that they have when they write, when they set pen to paper, because the pen is merely a conduit, the flow of the ideas from my brain to the other person's brain. And this tender, most tentative placement of the nib against the ink, against the paper, is the most delicate spider web, strong yet so fragile. And it's like, oh, for God's sake. And so now you're going to tell me which two ink bottle inks you buy, now what proportions you mix them in. Like, how about you actually show me some of these stories you say that you're supposed to be writing? These great, you've just written 1,000 words telling me how what a satisfying day you had because you suddenly asked yourself, what would Algernon, the name of my character in my pirate vampire novel, what if Algernon were to have a Q-tip in his hand and doesn't understand? Okay, well, why don't you just show me this story? Just tell it. I don't care how you felt at the end of the workday. So that's I'm exaggerating only a little bit. Yes. I mean, that's the sort of frustration I go through. That's why there used to be a couple of different websites where you could write just 2 or 3 sentences, and that would be like the fiction thing that you were publishing. I think one of them was called Ficlets. And on the one hand, I think that anything that encourages people to write is great. Anything that encourages people to share what they've written, also great. There should be nobody telling you that you're not writing enough, or this isn't a good enough thing, or this is not something that anybody would be interested in. One of the weirdest experiences I had in college was I decided to see if I was writing some humor pieces, and I thought, I wonder if the newspaper would like to use it, the college newspaper. So I just walked in and offered it to them, and they read it. And just the editor looked up from his desk and just said with a blank expression, why would we want to publish this? I said, well, okay, A, you might have a point there. I don't know. But the answer to that question is because you're a volunteer-run publication. Most of the stuff that I've read in your newspaper has absolutely no interest to me whatsoever. I thought that, well, whatever. So I'm not trying to say people shouldn't be writing and publishing. The only thing that I didn't like about these little micro publishing sites was that this is so not writing. I don't mean the quality. I mean that it's not coming up with a quick idea and writing a paragraph and saying, oh, well, I've wrestled with my muse and now I must, and now I'm entitled to get drunk and sing songs in the pub about being a writer. It's like, it really is about writing 2,000 words that are just absolutely terrible. I mean, just ungodly bad. Mm-hmm. But being interested enough in something in that bad 2,000 words to keep developing it and teasing it up into, in the case of a novel, you know, 120,000 really awful words, but then keeping at it and actually making it better and better and better. So it's I don't think little of these people who were publishing things in these microsites, just that it's sort of like the difference between you can go to the mall and go into this motion simulator that will simulate the exhilarating experience of parachuting, or you can actually do it. There's nothing stopping you from doing it. And if you really liked that little taste that you got, you should really try the thing where it's you're so confused at times, you don't know where it's going, you know that you're, you enjoyed the little bit of it that you experienced, and you really want to try it some more. I really hope that people, it doesn't lull these people into just banging out these one paragraphs, two paragraphs, and not really prosecuting an idea into a full story, because I've seen some really brilliant stuff on these sites, and it would be a shame if these folks never decided to write something that was longer form.
Mm-hmm. Only slightly less offensive to me are the people who write the stories about writers.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
And so my hero, you'll never guess what he does.
Yeah, you see a lot of this in fan fiction, like in science fiction, where suddenly the only person who can save the Enterprise being captained by Picard and a time-traveling Kirk, all of whom are like trapped and imprisoned by the Klingons, is a lowly system administrator, Lieutenant Jared Merdinson. Who grew up on a small farm community on Beta Z that's much, much less like Worcester, Massachusetts. It's like, okay.
When people find out that you're a writer, what's their reaction? Did they have a particular question for you?
Well, the thing is, hey, can you fix my iPhone? Because I tried to change the ringtone, but now I can't get it off silent. Because I'm certainly like, well-known as a tech writer as opposed to a fiction writer. Mm-hmm. But usually when I get that question from usually a new FedEx driver on my route who wonders, gee, you're always home at 11 o'clock in the morning for a package. And they do nothing but meet people who are home at 11 a.m. for packages. But they deliver enough packages from Microsoft and Apple that they ask what I do for a living. And usually I say, oh, well, I write about technology. It's the thing that they really want to know is, you know, how do you figure out what to write? That's usually a mixture of I'm established enough that companies will approach me with, hey, there's this thing that we're going to be releasing in 2 or 3 months. Can you meet with like one of our vice presidents in a couple of weeks? He's going to be coming in through New England. And if you sign something that says that you don't talk about what you saw until we're ready to release, we'll give you advanced look. We'll let you play with it for a few weeks, that sort of stuff. And some of it is just keeping an eye on the blogs, talking to lots of people, and whatever seems interesting and seems to be valuable to other people is the stuff that I put down. Fortunately, I'm not in the same position as the folks on Gizmodo and Engadget and The Verge, where it really is their job to every day have at least 6 different news items, no matter how simple the information is. It's valuable information because they'll be the first people to ever write about that anywhere. That's the first distant early warning sign of a new piece of technology coming out. Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas is the largest tech show in the country. I think it's second in the world. And these websites, they have to just take it like a D-Day invasion on that convention site. Fortunately, I have a little bit more freedom where I can just pick and choose the things that Lenovo has come up with a hybrid ultrabook laptop, that doesn't necessarily mean that I have to write about it. If I think it's interesting enough that an average person that might factor into their view of the world or either even their thoughts about what they want to buy in 6 or 7 months, then it becomes interesting to me. But the fact that it simply exists doesn't mean that I have to write about it. And that's what gives me a half hour off in the middle of the day to talk to you.
What's the best thing about your job?
Probably that it really is a job in which I can explore ideas and really prosecute them to the fullest. It would probably be very frustrating to me if every single day I had orders given to me and definitions from the outside about what's important to achieve today. And I would have to say, well, gee, in the course of writing about this and in the course of investigating this, I actually found something that's far more interesting and far more relevant. But then, unfortunately, no, this thing has to be done by 4:30. I don't believe in it. I don't think that people are going to be interested in it, but it's my job to actually go ahead and do that. Whereas my job is to just do the best job I can. I really do see myself as the person that has the sort of experiences with the wide range of technologies and ideas that almost everybody would have if they had that same opportunity. I'm not necessarily writing for the average person who has absolutely no interest in this sort of thing. But I'd like to think that by the time this person reads what I've written, they're getting a very broad range of experiences in 30 minutes or 45 minutes or 10 minutes, however long it takes for them to read the thing that I've written. And that they know that what I've chosen to write about has a certain authority behind it, in that I'm not just writing about it because I got a press release about this new product and I wanted to pass along this information. I'm writing about this because of the 20 press releases I got today, I thought this was really, really interesting. And after 2 or 3 days of looking into it, that confirmed my first impression that this was really, really interesting. So I really do like the idea that by the time I write something, it's something that I believe in very, very fully. And I'm very, very pleased. I've got enough ego to be pleased that after writing for doing this job for so long, good or bad, my name does have a certain authority behind it. Just like you might not necessarily agree with a certain movie critic, but you know that, well, at least he doesn't have his thumb up his, you know what, I think he has the wrong conclusion, but I know that he believes this thing that he's talked about. He didn't just simply rewrite a press release.
Let me turn the question around. What's the worst thing about your job?
Probably that things move so fast. It's kind of the same question, where the clock, especially when I get a brand new piece of technology, or if I'm given a 2-week lead on something, the clock is definitely running, because there's going to be a time when this information is no good to anybody. I'll give you an example. Next week, I'm going to be publishing a review of Android phones that's rather larger than I originally intended it to be. Because over 2011, I would get lots of whatever the hot new phone was, oftentimes before it was going to be released anywhere. And I would try to find, figure out what I wanted to write about this. And I would never like the answers that I got. It would always be, I'm going to be writing about reviewing this phone because it's been getting a lot of advanced publicity and a lot of people are going to be interested in it. However, I don't think it's very good. There's going to be another thing. I know for a fact there's going to be another phone coming up in a couple of weeks. I'd much rather save that slot and save that bandwidth in my column for 2 weeks from now when there's going to be another phone that's kind of similar to this. This particular phone, it isn't so big that I have to write about it. For instance, when Apple comes out with a new iPhone, whether it's good or whether it's bad, you have to write about it because it is a news story. They release stuff so rarely that anything that they release becomes a news item. Mm-hmm. And so I'll sort of like, by the time I'm done thinking about this new phone that I don't really like, or it's not that I don't really like, it's just I don't have a really strong opinion about it. It's now been out for about a month and everybody else has written about it. And now I feel kind of weird about reviewing this thing. And so honestly, that happened like 2 or 3 times in a row because we were really waiting for the very latest version of Android to come out. And so this piece that would have been 2 or 3 separate reviews of 2 or 3 separate phones is now going to be sort of a report card for Android, because that's the only way that I can really talk about all this new hardware and these new operating systems and make it sound as though it's completely relevant. Mm-hmm. So that's the definite downer, where there is right now, there is a week from now, and then there's never, it seems, when you write about the news.
What type of person would be good at your job?
Someone who, I guess 2 different kinds of people would excel. Someone who doesn't really get hung up on, who doesn't think too hard about what they do. I'm describing the ideal news reporter. All they know right now is that a large airship attempting to dock in New Jersey suffered a catastrophic accident. And it's really important, right? Your job as a news reporter is to report what you know, even if you don't know everything. And tomorrow you can get into why, what happened to make the Hindenburg explode. And a week from now you can get into who was responsible for making it explode. Today you simply have to make sure your facts are right and publish. The other sort of person who can excel is the exact opposite of that. The person who can go beyond simply the facts that, facts are facts. Anybody can get them and anybody can write them. You need to have a certain kind of imagination and capacity for abstract thought to think about, does this mean that travel by Zeppelin is now completely over with? How will this affect the Goodyear company that's been, has a contract to build 4 airships for the United States Navy? How will this affect the region that manufactures the skins of these airships? Or is there a way that they can fix these problems? And this is just an old technology that they were going to be getting rid of soon anyway. This is just simply hastens a demise that was going to be happening to this industry sooner or later. Both of these sort of approaches to news and information are incredibly valuable to people. And if you're one or the other, you'll do great. If you're somewhere in between where it takes you 2 days to simply report the facts, that's no good. If it takes a week of thought and you're just saying, whoa, bummer for airships, eh? You also are not very useful to people. Those are the two people who'd excel at a job like mine.
If they wanted to. How would one get a job like yours?
It's both. I was about to say it's both easier and harder than it used to be. I would actually say, though, that it's easier, because the bad news is that the number of organizations that are willing to hire you to do my job is definitely lower than it was when I got started 15 or 20 years ago. I started first year in college. And though there were like nothing but tons and tons of magazines and tons of newspapers out there. But the really good news is that you don't have to get anybody's permission to do my job. All you have to do is go to Tumblr.com, set up for a free account, and write something good and write something on a regular basis. Either it's on a daily basis or the same Monday, Wednesday, Thursday per week, or even just the same Monday per week. Eventually you write enough good stuff that the people who actually have the money and can actually hire you will look at your stuff. Ideally, you will show them your stuff and you'll start actually getting paid for what you do. In fact, in 2012, it's not even terribly necessary that you do as much as that. You can publish yourself. There are ways that you can generate money from your writing that does not involve having it published on a magazine site or a commercial website. There are ways to simply do electronic publishing and sell your stuff directly to the people who are reading your things. The downer side is that the thing that hasn't changed in 20 years is that you can never really predict how you'll get to that successful level. There's an analogy that someone made to me about being a successful independent filmmaker that I've always thought about. Where you imagine over the course of X years, 1,000 people, sport skydivers, jump out of airplanes and their main chute fails and their reserve chute fails. 1,000 people, let's say that happens to 1,000 people over whatever period of time. One of those 1,000 people lives and walks away unhurt. If you want to find out how to jump out of an airplane without a parachute, you don't ask that one person who walked away unharmed. All he can say is, here's what happened to me. Here's what I did step by step that caused me to land in this pile of sand and straw that caused me to bruise a few ribs but be okay. If you try to duplicate what this person did, unfortunately, that those circumstances are never going to happen again. But you can create your own set of circumstances where you can't predict that you only had maybe 500 readers to the blog that you were creating, but one of these people had a very successful commercial podcast and invited you to come in as a guest a few weeks, and that actually got your name in front of more people, that got more attention to your site, that got attention to another podcast that you do for free, but got your name out to more and more people, and suddenly you find yourself in a position where you can charge a dollar for an ebook and get about 4,000 people sending you that dollar. So and then you'll find yourself 5 years later answering that question saying, well, I can't say that you can try to get 500 people, make sure that one or two of those people are influential people and will recommend you. Really, the starting point is always going to be publish, 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 and do things that are really, really good and valuable. That's not a guaranteed path to success, but it seems as though everybody I know who is successful in something creative, it starts off with, well, what do you got?
Mm-hmm. Or start with 1,000 people who will give you a dollar.
And are willing to shove you out of an airplane without without a parachute.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day like for you?
A long time ago, I sort of cut my workday into three sessions. The first, I usually wake up at around 8. By 9 o'clock, I start the morning session, and that could be anything from that can be anything from just like tackle emails, like writing emails to people, answering emails that have come in. If I wrapped up a draft of something last night, it might be the time that after a good night's sleep, I can look at it with fresh eyes, do the final edit, and send it into my editor. I've got editors on the West Coast as well as the East Coast and in London, so I got almost every time zone covered. So it's a nice mental deadline to finish something the night before it's due, and then have it ready for an editor like in California by the time he or she gets to their desk at 9 a.m. on Pacific time. For me, that's noontime. And then I break for lunch. Then the afternoon session starts at around 2 o'clock and will go until about dinner time. The evening session is usually the time that I will do like the most intense writing because it starts roughly the time that offices close in California. I know that I'm not going to be getting any email from Chicago or San Francisco saying, hey, could you edit this or can you change that? Or, hey, this news item just crossed the wires. Could you write something about this by the next 45 minutes? So from 8 o'clock in the evening, 9 o'clock in the evening until about 1 or 2 in the morning, those are times I can just focus and not be interrupted. So I would love to create the impression that I'm doing nothing but working from 8 a.m. until 2 a.m. But that's why I've designed like my workday into these three sessions. It really comes down to, do I feel like I've done something productive, that I've accomplished something? And oftentimes, absent pressure from other deadlines, if I've finished, filed something in the morning that I'm very happy with, I won't necessarily work during the afternoon session. I might just take the computer to the bagel place with the Wi-Fi nearby and spend the afternoon doing a combination of just little edits, little bits of work, or just reading. Or I might just goof off for the whole afternoon and then get back to work like after dinner. Sometimes I was on a roll and I was actually up until 4 or 5 in the morning. So I wound up sleeping all the way through the morning session. but that's really the way it works. And also, it also gives me the freedom to, when you're self-employed, you really do need structured times during the day. So if I'm going out to dinner with friends, I know that the morning session and the afternoon session are really, really important, that I can't schedule anything else for that afternoon. And no, I can't just go to the bakery cafe in the afternoon to do a little bit of work because I need to be, you know, I don't really want to spend that half hour it's going to take me to drive there and back and to get used to the idea of being in a new place. No, got to work, because if you don't finish this by 6, you don't get to go out to dinner. So here's why you're going to be, here's how you're going to spend the morning and the afternoon.
And everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Couple of things. One is a cheap trick, and the other one is just being an adult. I really have trained myself to think of, well, what at the end of the day, what did you accomplish? What did you finish? Sometimes, you know, I'm working on a book and I can't write a whole book in a day. So I'm just going to finish a little bit of it, or I'm going to do some of the research for it. But if 2 or 3 days go in a row in which I didn't finish something and publish it, meaning send it to an editor, get to the point where I'm never going to read this again, I'm never going to edit this again, I'm never going to add stuff to this again, this is done. That's really a kind of a warning shot across my bow, saying, "Well, okay, well, you know, why didn't you finish that? Like, why are you overworking this too much? Are you getting obsessed about this? Why don't you just actually finish it?" It really is just a sense of scheduling your day in such a way that you have tangible goals for the day and for the week, so that at the end of the day or at the end of the week, you can really see that, well, geez, I really wanted to finish this column. I didn't. So now you sort of put more pressure on yourself for the next day to get that done. Because if you don't, you can't really be precious about your stuff, particularly if you're a writer, because you can get yourself into that really self-indulgent infinite loop where you keep telling yourself that, oh, I need one more draft, or I need to look at this from one more angle, or I need to talk to one more person about it. And you get to the stage where, yes, at an early stage, another hour's worth of effort will improve something by 30%. When you get to the next stage, another day's worth of effort will improve something 5%. Then you get to the stage where another week's worth of effort will improve something 1%. And that's the point which you know you're just wasting your time. So that's just being alert to, here's my goals for the day and the week, and here's what I actually accomplished. That's what spurs you on. I started doing something kind of silly recently, because now I have like more complicated goals and more things that have to be like in progress at the same time. You just print up a year long calendar in one sheet format. You can in Mac OS, there's even a command line terminal command called cal. If you type cal 2012, it will actually generate for you a complete 2012 calendar that fits on one page. And then you just print it out, write a header on it, and put it onto your fridge with magnets. One of them refers to each major project I've got going on, and every single day at the end of the day, when if I've written another 500 words of fiction, I basically get my Sharpie pen out and black out that date on the calendar. And it really, as you prepare your morning oatmeal with blueberries, when you see that, oh geez, I had a four day streak going, and then now 2 days which I haven't done anything. Today I really have to keep going on that. You really do need a tangible reminder of your progress, or else you won't progress.
Your own version of a Nat chart. Huh?
Yeah, well, I suppose that if I have a friend who he and his wife. Actually, they're both my friends, but they have their own publishing company, and of course they live together. And so if either one of them slacks, the other one is saying, Holly, you're supposed to have that fit. What am I going to put on the website today? Huh? Just tell me what I'm going to put on the website today. So I suppose that they don't need tricks like that, but I do.
When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
By walking away. When I get really frustrated that the thing that I'm working on right now is just not coming together, and there's never any excuse for not writing. So the hell that a writer can be in is that you can't just tell yourself, oh well, I'm blocked creatively, I just don't have it today. Well, real writers write, even if you can't be afraid of writing something that's bad, because that'll at least get you a little bit closer to the actual solution. And so I will spend those 2 hours writing a draft of a column that, oh man, it's poorly written, it doesn't really come to the point. I thought it was an interesting topic, but judging by this, there's nothing interesting about this. Fortunately, if you stay far enough ahead of your time on deadlines, you have the option of saying, okay, I'm just sort of frustrating myself and not making any progress. Now I'm going to put this aside and work on something else, even if it's something that has nothing to do with any of my deadlines. It's not something that anybody's expecting. I'll just write something for fun. Or even I will just get in the car, I'll load up a couple podcasts, I'll go for a drive, I will go to the bakery cafe with my iPad, I will read a book for a good 2 hours. And by the time that 2 hours is up, I will have totally forgotten about my complete and utter inability and my total failure to be a functioning working writer. I will remind myself that I have written before, I've written again. Get over yourself and just work on this.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Yes, but that's kind of personal.
Not as interested in the event as I am in the reason for asking the question, which is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through your challenges?
Let me think. I guess the larger principle is to never assume you know everything about everything. Because when you're totally confused about an issue, particularly when you're totally confused about a person's behavior, the likely answer isn't that this person is acting irrationally, or this topic is not understandable, this topic makes absolutely no sense. The usual correct answer is that you haven't looked at it from enough angles yet and from enough perspectives. And that if you sort of embrace a sense of humility that says that I know nothing, I understand nothing, not a self-recrimination sort of thing. I'm just being humble enough to say that I don't fully understand anything in this world, and that as certain as I am at this moment that this piece of software is incredibly poorly designed, it's possible that the person who wrote this had a really clear picture of what this thing was supposed to do, and that once I figure out what that is, or God forbid, email this person and ask them, this thing will actually make sense. And maybe I still won't like it, but it won't be the complete miserable waste of time that I think it is right now. There are two advantages you get from that. One of them is that usually is the case, that even if in terms of personal relationships, if someone is acting like a total jerk, there's a possibility that they're a narcissist, or they have some sort of disorder, or something happened to them when they were a kid that causes them to not know how to relate to the humans at all. But it's possible that you just simply don't understand where they are in their lives at this point, what their goals are, what their motivations are, what they were expecting of you, whether or not they have communicated that to you or not, or whether what they expect is actually reasonable. Usually you will figure out, you if you really function and focus on it and come at the problem with a sense of humility, you will figure out what that thing is, and you might solve the problem completely. Even if you don't solve the problem, you'll at least the world will make more sense to you. In those rare occasions when someone is acting completely reproachably, completely disgusting and absurd manner, or when you have a piece of software that is just really a total piece of junk, by the time you get to that conclusion, you will feel as though you've earned it, that you're not giving someone or something a bad rap that they don't deserve. You felt as though there were 100 steps that you're forced to go through before you conclude that this is an awful, awful movie. and you went through, on file, on record, is the checklist, all the paperwork of the 100 steps you went through before you got out the rubber stamp that said this movie is a terrible piece of junk. And so by the time someone says, well, why did you say that about this movie? It's a wonderful movie. You won't have that horrible experience where you realize that, oh my God, this person's right and I'm wrong. It reminded me of another movie I didn't like, and so I just sort of prejudged it. I never gave it a chance. By the time you get to step 100, you're like, I have already considered every argument I think you're going to present. I'm going to listen to every argument you present, but I don't honestly believe you will present me with something that I haven't figured out before. When it comes to people, the worst thing to do is to judge them without really thinking things through. By the time you do get to step 100, though, you do have to decide that, okay, I have done all my due diligence here. I'm not going to hate this person, but I'm going to be very, very careful about my interactions with them in the future.
If you're giving a commencement address for high school or college, giving your best advice, what would you say?
Let's see. Probably that most of the answers to your personal and your professional life are in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. At the very, very end, where Scrooge wakes up on Christmas morning and he pledges to keep the spirits of Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future in his mind at all times. That's pretty much the guide to most of the small and the big decisions, where at all times you have to learn from the past. You have to have a good plan for what you're going to do today immediately. And you also have to think about, well, what do you want to do in the future? You can really achieve pretty much every future, any goal that you really want to, but it doesn't come from just being determined to do it. It comes between figuring out what the next step is toward that goal. And that's one of the greatest gifts that nature gives to young people, that when you're 17 or 18, you really do feel as though you can do or be anything you want to do. You can accomplish pretty much anything. That even if your goal is at 18 that I want to be a multimillionaire musician. Maybe multimillionaire is a bad thing, but I want to be a musician with an audience and who can make a living as a musician. You can do that. You don't do it by, getting high and doing one gig a month and you say, oh, I'm a musician, man. I can't go to school because I have to focus on my music. You do that by figuring out that, well, I've got to start playing and playing and playing and playing and playing to get technically proficient. learning from other people's pasts and realizing that the Beatles didn't become the Beatles because they remained a cover band. They became the Beatles because they became inventive and created things that nobody else was making at the time, so that they would corner the market on being the Beatles. All they have to do is become the Beatles. So long as you always have a gosh, this is why I would, if I were giving a commencement address, I wouldn't do it as a first draft. Basically that you get somewhere by having a destination in mind. That would be the bumper sticker version of it. You get somewhere by having a destination in mind. And if your goal is just to, I'm going to play my guitar today, or I'm going to write something today, or I'm going to pick up a piece of trash by the side of the road today, that's a good thing to do, because we'll get you to the goal of, within a month, there will be no trash on this sidewalk where I wait for the bus every morning. And by the end of the month, you will have a short story written. By the end of the month, you will have a new song written that you didn't have written before. But you have to do those things every day towards the goal of, here's what I want to do by the end of the month. Here's what I want to do by the end of the year. You even have to start thinking about, here's what I want. Here's what I want to be when I'm 65 and I don't feel like working anymore.
My last question is, help me get better at this process. Is there a question I didn't ask that I should have? Or something that you wanted to say, or a story you wanted to tell that you haven't?
There's one question that is the launch bar to 45 minutes of great conversation with anybody. And it's simply, what do you believe?
So, Andy, what do you believe?
Well, I asked the question first. As background, it's a fun question, because oftentimes you ask that question to somebody and they haven't really thought about that before. And oftentimes some people will interpret it as, do you believe in God or not? Some people will interpret it as, what's the most important thing in your life? If someone finds that answer, though, it really is an answer from which pretty much every other answer forms. And the bumper sticker answer to that question for me would be that humility is the source of everything good that happens. And that's something that could be articulated in 100 different ways, that, you're not the center of any room. You're not the center of the universe. You're not the most important thing in any equation. That think about how you can help other people. Think about how you can create something positive as opposed to consume something. Every time I think that I'm headed towards the wrong decision, it's because I lost a sense of humility. And that's not in the sense of, gosh, I'm Andy Anatko. This is, of course, I can take two Danish off this tray instead of one. I'm Andy. I just mean the sense of, well, why do you think that it's why do you think that if I'm really struggling with a review of a major product or a major news item, it's like, it's easy to get into the struggle. Oh, well, this has to be brilliant. This has to be perfect. It's like, well, what? You think that you're the only person trusted with this information, and you're the only source of information about this, that the world is lined up waiting. There no loaves of bread are going into the oven. No gas is being pumped. No surgery is being performed, because everybody's just lined up waiting by their web browsers to read this thing that you get. Just finish the damn thing and go get dinner. So that's why I like that simple statement, that most everything that results from a good decision results in just maintaining my humility about my place, not only in the world, but in this room in which I'm sitting alone right now.
I want to thank Andy Anatko for joining me today. Thanks, Andy. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ken.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.